Are you ready?
Friday's Friday's Friday, and I'm out by Friday.
Friday night, not that Friday night fever.
Yes, Friday! Woo!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and happy First Amendment Friday. Let me say this to begin with. About 3 months ago, there was a terrible tragedy that happened in Longview, Washington, and 11 people died. And based on what we know today, I think somebody should go to jail. Now, I understand that ordinarily you see something like this happen and you say, well, certainly there are going to be lawsuits for loss of life when 11 people are killed and other people are badly hurt. Now, where did it happen? It happened at a paper company owned by a Japanese company, Nippon Dynawave, located in Longview. Now, the company Nippon, which is one of the biggest paper companies in Japan, bought this plant from Weyerhaeuser quite some time ago. So they've been operating it ever since. But based on what we know today, the company knew that that tank was dangerous. They knew that it should not be used, and they used it anyway, and people died. Certainly there should be lawsuits. Certainly there should be compensation for the families left behind. But I think it should go beyond that. I think the Cowlitz County prosecutor should bring charges. Now, if you say, well, Lars, are you going to get the Cowlitz County prosecutor on the show? I'm not even going to bother to call, because if the Cowlitz County prosecutor is considering bringing charges, the last thing she's going to do is come on a radio show and talk about her plans for prosecution. But here's my suggestion. If you know that something is flawed in an industrial plant, and how do we know that they know this? Well, the company had hired a contractor, and they hired them in 2025. And what did that contractor determine 10 months before the incident on May 26th that killed 11 people? That contractor, which inspected the tank, and they came back to the company and they said, quote, it is not fit for continued service, meaning it is already flawed. They found significant thinning that meant the walls of the tank had fallen below what they considered the minimum safe thickness in the lower regions of the tank. Now, let me compare this to something that you and I have run into any number of times. You might take your car or your pickup truck into a shop, and you might say, I'm kind of concerned about the brakes and the tires. And the shop comes back to you and says, yeah, you know, I think you're going to need new tires in about 10,000 miles, but not before then. And you're probably going to want to do a brake job on this rig in about 5,000 miles. And you say, but it's okay to drive today. Yes, it's okay to drive today. Now, imagine if you are running a commercial rig of some kind, a commercial vehicle in your company, and you have somebody take it into the shop, and the shop says, this vehicle is not safe to drive today. It is not safe to drive this vehicle away from the shop. You need to fix the following things. Otherwise, this vehicle is not fit for service. Let me ask you, if you, as the owner of that company or the manager of that company, if you say, let's go ahead and we'll use this vehicle for now, and we will get it fixed somewhere down the road. The company ignored this report 10 months before the incident in May that took the lives of those 11 people and left so many other people badly, badly hurt. Of course, there's going to be a lawsuit. But I think whoever it is that made the decision here in America, they may have even bucked it up the chain of command to their bosses in Tokyo. But if they made the decision here and said, we are going to ignore the report that we commissioned, so it was Nippon Dynawave that hired the contractor to come in and inspect the tank. Now, what do they find? The same contractor inspected the tank in October of 25 and February of 26, and both times identified that, quote, large portions of the tank remain thinner than the calculated minimum safe wall thickness. And what did they do about that? The company did not remove the tank from operations. And you know what was inside that tank? Remind yourself of what was going on May the 26th. There were people who had gone to work at Dynawave. Inside that gigantic tank was 900,000 gallons, not of water, not of something unpleasant. It was 900,000 gallons of caustic liquid called white liquor. So even if it had been full of pure, clean water, 900,000 gallons released in a flood would have at least hurt people badly, if not killed people. Because it was a caustic white liquor, it ended up taking the lives of 11 people. I'm going to suggest that if the Cowlitz County prosecutor is not preparing to bring negligent homicide charges against somebody at Nippon Dynawave, then maybe at the next election, that prosecutor should be replaced by somebody who will do the job. I think this is negligent homicide. Now, do I say that as a non-lawyer? Yes, I do. Do I know generally what the, well, what the definition of negligent homicide is? Yeah, I think I do. Negligent homicide means that when you decide to ignore something that is your job, you've hired a company to tell you, is this tank safe? They've told you it's not safe. It's not safe 10 months from now. It's not safe today. You need to do something about it today. And then you have them come back and take another look. Your first look is July of 25. Your second look is October of 25. Your third look is February of 26. And on each of those, they say, this tank ain't safe. And you make the conscious decision and say, we are not going to do anything about it. And a couple of months after that last inspection in February, on May the 26th, the entire tank simply comes apart and 11 people die. Now, was that a foreseeable outcome? If you've been told that the tank is too thin to contain the weight of 900,000 gallons of white liquor, is it a foreseeable accident that you could say, we know that if this thing ever comes apart and there is anybody at work here at the plant, they are going to be either badly hurt or killed? Is that negligence? I would argue, as a non-lawyer, I would argue that is negligence. And if you've taken somebody's life through negligence, then that's negligent homicide. I would love to talk to the Cowlitz County prosecutor and find out whether or not she plans to bring charges. If they aren't already considering it, they should be considering it. And at the very least, they ought to communicate to the public, this is what we plan to do because we know this is a problem. We know that there was negligence. Somebody has to be held responsible. And simply writing big checks to the families of the survivors, I don't think that goes far enough. I would even venture this. If this company operates in such a way that even when it knows it has a problem, like it knew because it had been put on formal notice, you have a problem. This is a tank that is not going to hold together. And then it doesn't hold together and 11 people die. Should you even allow that company to continue to operate in the state of Washington? I would argue they should not. They should be unwelcome to operate if that is the way that they maintain things. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. And our ex-poll question today, should illegal aliens get the privilege of paying in-state tuition to go to college in Oregon and Washington? Both Oregon, Washington, New Mexico, and Arizona are now being sued by the United States Department of Justice because they put illegal aliens at an advantage, a tens of thousands of dollars advantage over the citizens of the United States of America. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Tell you a bit about FMI.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? pumped by River City Environmental. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, has the time finally come to demand a prenuptial agreement from so-called public servants? It happens all over the Pacific Northwest. I see so many government agencies where when somebody leaves that agency, even when they leave under a cloud, they generally leave with a giant golden parachute. But Portland seems to be the worst offender lately. 8 times in the past 14 months, Portland city government has parted company with folks it hired at big salaries, six-figure salaries, to do important jobs. Most of the time, the public never ever learns why these top dogs leave the job that they came into with great fanfare. Maybe they did a bad job and they got fired. Sometimes they steal from the public and they get fired. Other times they decide to quit and renege on the contracts they signed. So, 8 times in 14 months, that employee leaves and almost always gets a golden parachute on the way out the door. $1.5 million paid out in just over a year. The latest person got $220,000 to leave the job. Now, let's review the possibilities. If the six-figure hire is so bad at the job, is there any good reason for taxpayers to pay them to get them out? I don't think so. If the hire is good at the job, on the other hand, and the boss wants to fire them anyway, then fire their boss. And if the hire is harassed or badly treated on the job, fire the folks who are harassing them and keep them on the job. Now, if somebody is hired on a fat contract, agreeing to work for several years, and then they want to leave early, they should have to pay for the privilege, just as anyone in the private sector would have to do. Glad to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. I'll get to your calls in just a moment. I do want to mention this. I accidentally misgendered the prosecuting attorney for Cowlitz County. That's Ryan Gervinanian. I think it's Gervinan. And I said she instead of he. It was unintentional, and I apologize for that. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Dave writes in, Lars, today I heard about another camper who got ripped off by Fort Stevens State Park. Now, we talked to a lady earlier this week, and it happened to her. I have another beef with the parks. I recently spent a week at Wallowa Lake in a private cabin. As always, we put the boat in almost daily, parking the truck and the trailer near the ramp. There was no sign or any indication saying that marina parking was one of the 22 new fee areas that were added this spring. Apparently, I was supposed to scan a QR code on the entrance sign and then pay by phone. The only problem is there's no cell phone service in the area, and there is no other means provided for payment. Everything is closed in the early morning. The same system is in place at Fort Stevens Dump Station, also a new $10 fee. I can't get internet service there either. My only alternative is to pay the $60 annual fee and register my truck license plate. Lars, call me old-fashioned, but I don't use my phone for financial transactions, nor do many of my senior friends. Never have, never will. I wish the tech-savvy would stop demanding that we all do things their way. Signed, Dave in Hillsboro. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, on the same line that I was talking about earlier, the golden parachutes, Washington State is now paying $180,000 to the fired head of youth prisons who alleged retaliation. Well, there's an easy way to solve this one. Either she was complaining about something legitimate, brought things to a public light, and then was fired in retaliation, in which case you shouldn't have been firing her at all. Or she was fired for good cause because she wasn't doing a good job, in which case you shouldn't be paying her any money. But that's the bottom line. So shame on the state of Washington and the state of Oregon for all the golden parachutes. My favorite post on social media today, the FBI has now arrested a Honduran anti-ICE agitator for voter fraud in California. Darwin Jonathan Rivera Flores, 30, a Honduran national living in California's San Fernando Valley, was arrested by the FBI on federal voter fraud charges. Rivera Flores is charged with falsely claiming U.S. citizenship and fraudulent voter registration. He was previously arrested at an anti-ICE protest in Camarillo. I thought the Democrats said that illegal aliens were not allowed to vote. It is First Amendment Friday. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails. Let me start off with Helen. Hey, Helen, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just was listening to you talking about the city of Portland, multiple employees who've been brought in with fanfare and then let go and got pretty good golden parachutes.
Yep. And?
You know, the only reason any employer gives a severance package is so that that employee goes away forever and they don't have to worry about liability or them disclosing something about their job and why they left or what happened. And so, you know, sometimes the more leverage that leaving employee has, the more they'll pay them.
Helen, do you work for a government agency?
I do not. I used to in the past, yes.
All right. And see, that's why you have that attitude about the public's money. I left a job quite some time ago working for a TV station. I'd been there 14 years. I got 7 weeks of severance, all right? Now, when I signed that, I said it said, this is the end of our deal. I have no claims against you. You have no claims against me. Got 7 weeks of severance after 14 years there. Can you think of why, if we've got somebody who's agreed to take a job for several hundred thousand dollars, that we should pay them a year's salary to go away?
No, I disagree with it totally. I think it's awful, but I'm just saying that's the reason. The only reason
has to be tempered with somebody saying, well, how much do we have to pay to make this person go away? And what they've done is they've contaminated the waters, basically, by making everybody believe when you leave a public sector job, you're going to get half a year's pay. You're going to get three quarters of a year's pay. You're going to get a year's pay. And you say, hold on, why are we paying you that much money? If we're firing you because you're bad at your job, we shouldn't be paying you a dime. We're firing you for cause. If you're asking to leave early, and some of these people are, they walk in and they say, I signed on for 3 years. I'm done after two. I want to leave. You say, well, then you may have to pay us something. But the last thing we should be doing is writing somebody a year's paycheck just to make them go away, because the bosses don't care, because it ain't their money. It's our money.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's need. Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want you to imagine this. I often sing the praises of America's sheriffs. There are roughly 4,000 sheriffs in the United States because there are 4,000 counties in the United States of America. And the best thing about sheriffs, as far as I'm concerned, is they are a constitutional level of law. That is, they are elected, they are chosen by the people. If they keep their voters happy and do a good job, then they keep their job. If they don't keep the voters happy and they do a bad job, then they get fired by the voters. That's a very direct form of representation in government. And yet in Pierce County, county officials tried to quietly fire an elected sheriff midterm. So he took him to court and fought back with his own ballot measure. I want to talk about this political power grab that's happening in broad daylight. Sheriff Keith Swang joins me now, the elected sheriff chosen by the voters of Pierce County, Washington. Sheriff Swank, welcome back.
Thank you.
If I've misstated any of that, please feel free to correct me, but what in the world is going on in Pierce County? Do the county officials not understand the people of Pierce County chose you?
The Charter Review Commission was led by 12 on the left, so they had the majority, and they passed an amendment to go to the ballot this year to make the sheriff an appointed position. But also, in addition to that, on the 11th hour, without any public comment, they put in another part of this amendment that says that the sheriff, meaning me, will be removed from office on January 1st, 2027. So that would be at the halfway point through my four-year term. And so they'd be recalling me without having to do the recall process, right? Remove me from office without having to do the necessary steps for that. So, yeah, I filed an initiative.
Is that, let's before we go to the initiative, is that constitutional for a county to say we're going to propose a change to the county charter, but in the meantime, we want to take what the voters did in electing Keith Swank as sheriff, and we want to undo it and get rid of him before we've even asked about the other matter? Does that sound constitutional to you?
No, not at all. And three citizens of Pierce County have filed a lawsuit about that, saying that that's not constitutional. I believe it'll be having a hearing on September the 4th in Thurston County. So we'll see what the judge down there says. No, I don't think it's constitutional at all. The good thing about this lawsuit is Brian Sontag, who's a Democrat, is on it, and two Republicans. So it's a bipartisan thing because people on both sides or all sides of the political spectrum want to be able to vote for their elected officials, including the sheriff.
Well, and not only that, but what kind of case do they plan to make to the voters to say it's desirable to have an appointed sheriff? I know King County does, and I don't think much of what they get out of the result. And there are a few other counties in America where the sheriff is appointed by politicians rather than being elected by the people. But what do you think they're planning to say that will persuade the public, the voters, that this is something that's to their benefit?
Well, this is what they say, Lars. They say we have to make the sheriff an appointed position so we can protect democracy. That's what they say.
You're going to protect democracy by denying the voters of Pierce County the
yes.
right to choose their own sheriff?
Yes.
Are these people crazy
yes.
or what?
Yes, they are absolutely crazy. The whole thing is there's a guys on the Charter Review Commission don't like what I said on social media. They don't like what I said. A man is a man and a woman is a woman and a transgender woman is a man. And they're from the LGBTQ plus IA groups out there. And so they ran on that and they want to remove me from office because of what I said. They can't remove me from office for malfeasance or misfeasance or criminal activity because I haven't done any of that stuff at all, of course, and I wouldn't. But that's what they want to do. It's their last-ditch effort to get rid of the sheriff who they hate.
Okay, so now when we go to Amendment 53, that's the county's initiative, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
What and it proposes to change it to an appointed position. This is going to be voted on in November. Do you have any sense of what the voters of Pierce County will do with that?
First, I want to tell you that they wrote up a bad title to it, the prosecutor did, so we had to take them to court on it, and that cost $7,500. And thank you, people who gave money to that, because they didn't include in there that it would remove me from office. They hid that part. So we had to sue them, take them to court, and a judge ruled well on that, Judge Adams did. So the feel from the people, well, I filed an initiative the other day to make the sheriff an elected position, to protect the office of sheriff, change it from the charter from Department of Sheriff to Sheriff's Office. And anyhow, people showed up. I put it out, let people know I was going to be at the auditor's office. A guy showed up who said this to me, "I didn't vote for you, but I want to be able to vote for the sheriff that I pick." So there was a guy who took time out of his day, didn't even vote for me. So that's
wow.
a good sign, right?
Yeah, that's a great
sign. So well, I'm thinking the people of the Pierce County, whether they like me or not, they want to vote for their sheriff. I believe the majority wants to do that.
See, I can't imagine, especially when the folks who are always talking about protecting democracy, number one, we're not a democracy, but elected sheriffs in America are one of the last pieces where there's a tiny little bit of direct democracy. I don't think our country could be run as a direct democracy if you were to have to put everything to a vote nationwide or even region-wide. It would
right.
be impossible. It works for small towns somewhere, you know, maybe a northwest small town like Republic, Washington, you know, or I don't know, Vail, Oregon, you know, could work as a direct town hall democracy. Otherwise, it doesn't work. But at least you want to have those elements where you say, we choose our own sheriff. And if we're happy with him, we keep him. If I were a Pierce County voter, I'd be apoplectic. I'd be so mad at these people saying, you want to take away my right to choose the sheriff? Then I'm going to take away your job and send you packing.
Right. That's what I hope they do. I hope they do send some of these people packing. Well, Charter Review Commission was only for 6 months. So they're all gone. But the politicians who support this, right? Look, you know, I know, you listeners know, the only thing that the Democrats in Washington don't control yet are the sheriffs. They control all the legislature, all statewide offices, right? And the only thing standing between them and the people are sheriffs, not all of them, some of us, standing in there protecting the rights of our citizens, right? So,
yep.
They need to get us appointed so they can control us and tell you what to do, and then they can impose their will. So, yeah.
And by the way, Sheriff Swank, I don't know how much you have time to follow things happening in other parts of the country, but I was so glad. New York State. Now, New York City is very, very liberal, and some of the state is very liberal, but they have 15 sheriffs who've sued, and they've actually said, we're going to go to court because the state is trying to take away our right to do 287G arrangements with the federal government and be able to house illegal aliens when, you know, ICE needs to house somebody, to put them in our jails and to be able to take that role. And
right.
The state of New York is trying to tell them, no, we're going to void these 287G arrangements. Thank God the people in those 15 counties are represented by sheriffs who will say, no, you're not going to do that to us. We're going to go to court. Sheriff Swank, any other way we can help you out, by the way?
Well, yes, go to reject53.org. Thank you. Reject53.org. Sign up, volunteer, give us money. I'm helping that cause out to make sure we keep our sheriff in Pierce County elected. Whether it's me or whoever it is, I want you to have the right to vote for your sheriff or your choosing.
Reject53.org. Check it out. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. It is First Amendment Friday, so every subject is fair game. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, you're going to go right to the head of the line. Our ex-poll question today: should illegal aliens get the privilege of paying only in-state tuition to go to college in Oregon or Washington? Well, it turns out the United States Department of Justice has brought lawsuits. They brought this yesterday against Arizona, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington. And why? Because there are laws in all four states that allow immigrants, they call them immigrants, this is illegal aliens who have no legal status, to pay in-state tuition college costs in the states where they live. The Trump administration has now sued 21 states over such laws. So I want you to imagine this. If you consider University of Washington is a school where if you are in-state and you're considered an in-state student, you pay about $13,000 in tuition. That's a lot. But if you are out of country, then you pay $44,000, or about $31,000 or $32,000 more, because you're from out of country. Except now, the kid who comes to, say, University of Washington from Oklahoma, or from Florida, or from New York, or from Iowa, or Montana, or North Dakota, is going to pay out-of-state tuition. But the illegal alien who's illegally present in the state of Washington, it also applies to Oregon, will pay in-state tuition rates. So in other words, their education is going to be subsidized by the taxpayers of the state of Oregon. Why? Because the out-of-state or out-of-country tuition that is paid by students reflects the real cost of operating that school. And if you say, well, Lars, if that's the real cost, then how is it that in-state students pay so much less? The answer is they recognize the fact that in-state students have parents who are paying taxes in the state. That subsidizes the other $30,000 of education cost. Except now the states of Oregon and Washington, along with Arizona and New Mexico, have decided to take the money from the taxpayers and subsidize the college education of illegal aliens. Well, the Trump DOJ has brought a lawsuit against it. I'm going to ask you, should illegal aliens get the privilege of paying in-state tuition to go to college at taxpayer expense? Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Oregon voters overwhelmingly rejected a gas tax hike. That was only a couple of months ago in May, in the May primary. But now Salem is finding lots and lots of other things to tax instead. Now, I want to ask you this question. Consider what happened in May. In May, the governor's idea for a tax increase to bring in billions of dollars for the Oregon Department of Transportation, it was put to a vote, and it got a no vote by 83% statewide. Even in notoriously liberal Portland, it got a 70% no vote. So it was an overwhelming no vote. Now, did the people in Salem listen any better than the people in Olympia listened to the voters? They did not. What does the Fish Wrapper, the Daily Did Fish Wrapper, report today? Oregon officials are compiling an extensive list of potential taxes and fees that lawmakers may consider tapping to close a major transportation funding deficit next year. In other words, they didn't listen at all. They were told, live within your means. ODOT currently gets $3.2 billion per year, $6.4 billion every biennium. And they're being told live within the $6.5 billion. And ODOT is saying, to hell with that. We're going to give you more things to tax. And I would love to ask the people at ODOT. I'd love to ask Tina Kotek. Do you think the voters sent you a message when they said no to a tax increase by 83% no to 17% yes? And if you didn't get that clue, how big a 2x4 would you have to get hit by, metaphorically, to be able to get the message the voters said no? Let's go to Ryan. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was hearing you talk about the in-state tuition and how all these colleges are being sued by the DOJ for it.
Yep, for giving it to illegal aliens.
Yeah, so I will say I am a graduate of Oregon State University. I have a bachelor's in it. And actually, for several years while I was there, I was paying out-of-state tuition. Even though I lived on the border, just across the river in Vancouver, you know, that was where my address and residency was technically. They wouldn't recognize that as, like, I wouldn't get, like, a waiver or anything.
I'm trying to get to the point. What's the point you're trying to make?
The point was, if they lose, I hope that there is a class action for students like me who struggled for years in getting in-state tuition. I had to jump through 2 years. I had to put my whole education on hold for 2 years while I jumped through all their hoops, and I kept getting denied, denial after denial after denial, until they finally decided to grant me in-state tuition.
What did you get your bachelor graduate degree in?
Construction engineering management.
Are you using it?
Yes, I am currently using it.
I'm glad to hear it. I mean, I wish they'd grant I wish they grant lower cost tuition for anybody who's actually pursuing a degree that has a real usefulness, as opposed to the ones that end in the word studies.
You know, I totally agree. You know, I avoided all of those degrees, like they were the plague. And I made sure that I did not ever go down that path. You know, my mindset was, I'm in it to make money. I want to better my community as well as myself and my family. So,
well, imagine what they're telling people when the state of Oregon and the state of Washington say, we're going to give in-state tuition treatment to people who are criminally present in the United States. Imagine what they're telling their voters. They're saying, screw you, shut up, pay your taxes. We're going to give the same rate of tuition to an illegal alien that we have to give to your son or daughter going to school in the state. Now imagine that kind of insulting message. We're going to give a favored tuition rate to somebody who's criminally in the United States. Anybody who believes in that nonsense, I'd love to talk to that naysayer. And good luck to you, Ryan. Glad you got a degree that actually means something. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, brought to you by eLegacy. That's eLegacyLars.com. Set up your kids for success with a customized estate plan at eLegacyLars.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I love First Amendment Fridays because we open up the phone lines and every subject is fair game. And is always true on this show every week, every weekday, naysayers go to the head of the line. If you want to jump in and have a counterpoint of view, you're certainly welcome. In fact, you're going to go first in line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our poll on X. Now, the question today has to do with a Department of Justice lawsuit that was brought yesterday against, among others, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, and New Mexico, because those four states allow illegal aliens to pay only in-state college tuition. And I think that's outrageous. And apparently the Trump Justice Department does as well. So they brought a lawsuit. Here's the way we framed the question. I think it's relatively neutral. Should illegal aliens get the privilege of paying in-state tuition to go to college at taxpayer expense? My answer would be no. And just in case you're wondering, the difference between in-state tuition at, say, UW versus out-of-country tuition, if you're a foreign national, $31,000 a year is the difference. So, and we can also ask Jim Walsh about that. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. I got another mystery I want you to tackle first, though, so welcome back.
Oh, it's good to talk to you, Lars. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Representative Jim Walsh is chair of the Washington State Republican Party and a Republican state representative serving Washington's 19th legislative district. So tell me this. A Seattle nonprofit, and we've talked to them, We Heart Seattle, is cleaning up homeless camps and needles and all kinds of other nonsense and helping out the addicts. Why is Bob Ferguson's state government going after them?
It's the weaponization of government, Lars. It is the lowest level of where a government entity can fall when it's arrogant and full of itself and thinks there'll be no checks. The governor has sicked the State Department of Labor and Industry, L&I, which is a legitimate department that does some good work, to harass this charitable organization who uses volunteers, that they use volunteers to clean up homeless camps, and there are needles and there's drug paraphernalia in these homeless camps. They clean it up, and Ferguson has sicked the L&I inspectors on them to say that the volunteers for this charitable group aren't following safety protocols that usually apply to the medical world for dealing with needles and tinfoil that's been used to smoke fentanyl and all these other drug kind of garbage. They clean it up, and they're careful when they do it. But the idea of sicking the L&I inspectors on a charitable nonprofit that uses volunteers to do good work is shameless, Lars. And the L&I inspectors, they've got real work to do. You know, we have this big tank collapse that happened in Longview where people died. That's the right use of L&I. That's where we want L&I to be working, not harassing charitable organizations involved cleaning up homeless camps.
And by the way, Jim, I was kind of surprised. That happened not too far from where I live in Longview, and 11 people died, and I actually led off the show today because I think negligent homicide charges should be brought by the Cowles County prosecutor. But you're right. I was stunned when I found out. You mean you can have a gigantic tank, and as long as it's sitting on top of the ground instead of buried in the ground, then the state of Washington pays no attention to the tank whatsoever? That actually turned out to be the case, didn't it?
Yeah, and there's going to be some jockeying among the different government agencies and a little finger pointing back and forth, you know, who didn't call this one out right. But I believe that's where Washington L&I and Oregon's analogous workplace safety agency, that's where they should be working. That's the good place for them to be working, not harassing volunteers cleaning up homeless sites. So the governor needs to get his priorities straight and use these government agencies the right way. Don't weaponize them to harass a woman who's running a charitable organization doing good work. Come on, Governor.
Hey,
do it right.
Jim, is there any way to find out who gave the order to do this? And was there anybody within, say, L&I that said, hey, boss, you want us to do this stuff? Why are we doing this? There has to be somebody out there who thought this was a dumb way to go, but they were getting orders from on high. Any way to trace back through the paper chain and find out whose fingerprints are on it?
That's what the Public Records Act was made for, Lars. We're in the process of getting that information. I have heard from some individuals in positions to know that this was something that came from on high, from the higher office. So I don't have the backup for it yet, but we're working on it, Lars, and we're going to track it down. We're not going to let this issue go. And it's not just harassing the woman who runs We Heart Seattle. You know, there's some harassing going on with one of your colleagues in journalism, saying she's not a journalist, and they're using the PDC, another state government agency that Ferguson has stalked with his friends on their board. You know, this is a pattern I'm concerned about, Lars, of weaponizing these state bureaucratic agencies to go after people who question the current governor's administration, and that's bad. Weaponizing government is bad.
I mean, Jim, do they realize how dangerous it is for government to try to start to define what is a journalist and what's not? Because, number one, it's almost impossible to do. And number two, as soon as you start defining you are and you're not, I think you're crossing that First Amendment line, but good.
And the First Amendment, the federal constitution, Article 1 of the state of Washington's constitution, both give very clear protection to freedom of speech. And it's not less protection for politically oriented speech or commentary. It's more protection for political speech or commentary. So and the current governor in Washington is an attorney. He ought to know this stuff.
By the way, Jim, one thing I'd love to see you do, I mean, I said I didn't even bother to call the Cowles County prosecutor because I think he'd say even if we're considering charges, you know, he can't talk about it on the radio. But you know what I'd like to know? I'd like to know, are they considering negligent homicide? Because as of today, we've found out this company knew 10 months ago that tank was no good. 10 months before the tank collapsed in May, they knew the tank was not fit for service. Not that it was wearing out, but that it was already worn out and it was not fit for service. Well, if a company decides to go ahead and do that, to me it'd be like sending a guy with an 18-wheeler, you know, to the summit on I-90, you know, on his way to Spokane with bad brakes that the company knows are bad. And you say, well, can you foresee that that guy's going to end up dead and his truck's going to end up wrecked and people are going to get hurt? Yeah. And if you do that, isn't that negligent homicide? And shouldn't there be charges brought?
I believe that is work. That process will work itself out. I believe that the county prosecutor and others at the state and federal level are looking at that and weighing how to proceed. For my part, Lars, I want the state and federal government agencies that oversee these industrial activities to do a better job of not just identifying the problem, but fixing it when it occurs, or compelling the company
that they must fix the problem or people die. That's Representative Jim Wall. You taking care of your family?
National, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's amazing the kind of response you get, because the U.S. Postal Service was told by President Trump, we're going to make sure that if people, states meaning, are using vote by mail, ballots must be delivered only to people who have a legal right to vote. And that the federal government would actually produce lists of people who are legally able to vote. And why would you worry about legally able to vote? Because states all over the United States, from New Jersey all the way to the West Coast of the United States, have been finding that they have thousands and thousands of foreign nationals who are registered to vote. and they say, oh, but now we've cleaned them all out. Well, you thought you had cleaned them all out a couple of years ago when you declared this the tightest voting system ever, the most secure voting system ever. All of those pronouncements that came out after the 2020 election, after the 2024 election, it was always claimed, oh, it's the most secure election system we've ever had. We found tens of thousands of foreign nationals registered to vote. Yeah, but now we've cleaned them out, and now it's the cleanest system. I mean, it's the biggest bunch of hogwash you've ever heard. And you would think, I would think, that blue states, the Democrat-run states, would welcome the chance to double-check that their claim that it's an airtight voting system is actually true or not. In fact, consider this. The Committee to Unleash Prosperity, and that is our friend Steve Moore, the economist, he points out the Bipartisan Commission on Federal Election Reform. Now, this was a while ago. It was chaired by President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker. They overwhelmingly concluded that vote by mail did little to improve voter turnout. And that's turned out to be true 20 years after this report came out. It doesn't improve voter turnout much at all, but it does dramatically increase the risk of fraud and contested elections. And that has turned out, as Steve Moore puts it, to be the understatement of the decade. The opportunities for fraud magnified after 2020 because of relaxed bureaucratic rules issued during COVID. Today, 30% of all the votes in America are cast by mail. So President Trump issued an executive order. That was back in May. And he told the Postal Service, enhance ballot security by requiring states to provide lists of mail voters and then use federally reviewed ballot envelopes with unique barcodes for tracking. In other words, one of my biggest complaints about vote by mail is there is no chain of custody. The ballot leaves the elections office in an envelope and it goes somewhere. You think it goes to an address, but you're not sure. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have told me they have received ballots that are addressed to somebody who is not them, but it is addressed at their address, and that nobody else has lived at that address for 20 years, and yet they're still getting a ballot supposedly sent to a registered voter at their address who doesn't live at that address. Does that make sense? Well, one group of blue states immediately went to court, and they sued. And they say this violates the Voting Rights Act by intruding on the state's power to administer elections. But if the states are doing a bad job of it, well, this week, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday voted 6-3 to allow the Postal Service to go ahead and implement that order and say, this is what we're going to do. Well, it's going to be appealed to the Supreme Court, but early voting begins in about a month. The final decision will go down to the wire. You don't have to be a legal eagle, as Steve Moore points out, to follow the scam that's going on. The states do not want to deter the fraudulent voting that they know goes on undetected with mail-in ballots. You would think that leftists keep talking about dangers to democracy, that they want to do everything to protect the sanctity of the ballot, and then they do exactly the opposite. The second thing I want to mention to you, and it's pointed out by a great writer that I follow all the time. His name is Alexander Muse. And he writes on a Substack. It also shows up on X and other social media. And it's about the census. Because the Census Bureau has done its own internal audit of its own numbers. In other words, the census doesn't just count all Americans. But after the count, they go back and they do a double check. And they say, let's find out how much we were off. Well, guess what? They were off, except it turns out they're always off in a way that benefits the Democrats to the detriment of conservatives and Republicans. Now you say, Lars, you're always seeing some kind of conspiracy theory. No, consider this. When they went out and said, did we overcount or undercount a given state? Guess which states got undercounted? Tennessee, conservative. Florida, conservative. Texas, conservative. What were the states that got overcounted according to the census? Delaware overcounted by 5.5%, Rhode Island by 5%, New York by 3.5%, Hawaii and Minnesota, they were overcounted as well. Now, as Alexander Muse points out, those numbers are not from a conservative group. They're not from Heritage. They're not from National Review. They're from the Census Bureau itself. A 3.5% miss in a state like Minnesota, of 22 million people is about 750,000 people. That means that some states ended up with more representation in the Congress and some got less. Now, as he points out, and I thought this was the best way to say it, the 2020 count miscounted Americans in a pattern that only ran in a single direction, toward the states that the Democrats dominate and away from the states the Republicans dominate. In other words, the census, if you're going to make mistakes, how coincidental is it that the mistakes always benefit the Democrats and always come to the detriment of conservatives and Republicans? He says the direction is the whole story, and a great deal of official commentary has been devoted to persuading the public that direction can be ignored. Democrats and the press that covers them have spent 4 years talking as though a one-way miss is just weather. An error that always lands on the same party states is a thing a serious country investigates. Consider that. When you have mistakes that always fall in one direction, and think about the places where you would find these kinds of mistakes. Let's say you had a mistake in officiating in professional sports, except it always went to the benefit of one team and never went to the benefit of the other team. Except here, we're not talking about the outcome of a football game or a basketball game. We're talking about decisions that manage how America is run. And when those mistakes always benefit the Democrat Party and always come to the detriment of the Republican Party, that's a problem we should take a hard look at. Glad to be with you on First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up, what if donating your organs didn't happen after you died, but was actually how you died? It's a disturbing idea that's getting traction in certain medical circles. We'll talk about it coming up next.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails, especially on a First Amendment Friday. Now, over the years, I've been a fan of organ donation, although I don't know that I necessarily trust the system these days. But it has been creeping further and further in the direction of being able to harvest organs from people who are not yet dead. I thought we'd talk with Wesley Smith, who's both an author and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, welcome back to the program.
Lars, good to hear your voice again.
So tell me this. It has always been a question. You don't harvest organs from somebody until they are dead. And there's been a lot of time and effort invested in defining what does death actually mean. Is it the cessation of the brain activity? Is it the, you know, when the heart stops beating? And there are lots of those questions. Are we now reaching a point where society is ready to start harvesting organs from people who are still alive, and it's the harvesting of the organs that actually kills them? Have we gone that far?
We haven't gone that far yet, but I think there are many powerful voices in bioethics that want to take us that far, which is why I've been very concerned about this. This is about what's called the dead donor rule. The dead donor rule says that you only take vital organs from people who are dead, and the corollary to that is you don't kill people for their organs. Well, with the legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia, you've now had many bioethicists coming out, certainly not all, but some, saying, hey, since we're going to kill people anyway, let's conjoin that with organ harvesting, which is done in places like Canada, the Netherlands, Belgium, and so forth. And now they're actually saying, hey, you know what? The organs will be better if we actually kill people by organ harvesting instead of killing them and then organ harvesting. So you can see where the advocacy is heading. It's very disturbing.
Well, it is, especially because I would point out, and Wesley, correct me if I'm wrong, but the government is involved in all of this. The government is getting more and more involved in both health insurance and in medical care. And the government has a financial dog in the fight because some of these organs that are harvested will end up costing a lot of money to be able to put into somebody, but some of them have the great potential to save a lot of money. I guess I'd give kidneys as one good example, that if you have somebody on kidney dialysis, the person may or may not be able to work a job. Their dialysis is tremendously expensive. Get them a donated organ, and the dialysis all of a sudden becomes less of an issue. There are anti-rejection drugs, but overall, it's a cost savings that could be counted in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. So now we have an, you know, we have government that has a financial stake in how these things turn out, and then we're going to give them the power to say, go ahead and kill people while they're still alive, and then harvest their organs.
Well, that would, you know, the money issue can cut both ways. It's also a utilitarian question of, oh, people are going to be euthanized, so we might as well get some good out of them.
Right.
I am heartened, Lars, to say that Robert Kennedy has been pushing very hard to maintain ethics in organ donation. He recently decertified a Kentucky organ procurement organization precisely because they were following policies that almost had people who were clearly alive organ harvested. So I think a lot of it depends on whether we maintain these ethical guidelines in a very rigorous way. And I'm happy to say it appears that RFK, at least, is doing so, because he's done that once in Florida and now once in Kentucky.
Okay, and does the fact that those organizations slipped over toward that let's harvest while the person's still alive, does it suggest that maybe the medical community is starting to soften up on what should be a hard ethical stance? We don't take organs from somebody who's not dead. Is that starting to soften up?
There is a softening, in my opinion, but it hasn't yet tipped over. You know, the tipping point hasn't been reached. That's why I think it's important that you discuss it on your show, because the way to prevent this is light, right? Let people see what is being proposed. Let people see that some lines are being crossed, and that way you can push back, and this can become an unthinkable thing. It really is important that people be made aware of this, because the trust in organ donation is an inch deep. And if people ever come to think that their organs will be deemed more important than their lives, then I think the donation of organs will collapse.
See, and that's the concern I've got, because I don't know about you, Wesley, but I've seen a tremendous drop in the faith that most people have in the medical community, especially when we find out some of the things we've found out in the last few years about Anthony Fauci, about lies that were told to the American public, about politicians who said, take this vaccine and you can't get ill. And then it turns out, no, that's just a big fat lie, but lots of people made billions of dollars on it. When you have those kind of things happen on the vaccine side, I worry that on this side, that it'd be very easy for people to lose faith in the system altogether.
I agree with you, and that's why I'm really happy that you're discussing this on your program and to your audience.
So what is this that's meant when somebody says, I was looking at one of the lines from a piece that you wrote, but they said, DDR, the dead donor rule, is inconsistent with the less controversial bioethical policies. What's meant by that?
Well, there was some sophistry going on there. They were saying, for example, people can donate a kidney, a living donation.
Yeah.
And since you can, that causes harm, although the people who say kidney donation doesn't cause harm say it doesn't, but we know it does. Therefore, since that harms people, taking vital organs is the same thing. No. In a living kidney donation, in very rare cases, people don't die. In taking a liver, you're going to be dead in hours. So, I mean, there's all kinds of sophistry to try to justify this. They also talked about doing surgery on fetuses in the womb because, well, this causes harm to women in terms of their physicality. No, it protects the baby. So there's a lot of sophistry that goes on to try to, you know, wiggle through and justify the unthinkable, and we can't let it happen.
No, because when I look at that and I think, well, hold on a second. I think it's very easy to say if you always say you're not going to take organs unless the person is dead and dead of a natural cause. You're in an automobile accident. You have something else go wrong. But as you said, the minute you start to go down that road and say, oh, what about this person who's decided to take doctor-assisted suicide? or medical assistance in dying? Can we harvest their organs as well? The minute you're willing to take their organs, then I think you've got some real ethical problems. And trying to fake your way past that, that's a big problem. That is Wesley Smith. He's a regular on the show, an author and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wesley, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls on a First Amendment Friday. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LawrenceLarson.com. Our export should illegal aliens get to pay in-state tuition and go to college at taxpayer expense. A parking lot in
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the program. My email of the day, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Kurt writes in, Lars, I'm having a really tough time with this murdering ex-mother. He means Lindsay Clancy. I'm born as one of God's creations. I've never blamed anybody but myself for what I am or what I've done. I'm, by the Bible, a born sinner. I couldn't even think up as a logical human being how to blame somebody else. Too much premeditated thought went into this. She's evil and she knows it. I'm tired of these people who are walking free. Makes me wonder what technical medical description the modern day nut jobs would give to Hitler or Ted Bundy, etc. Bottom line, some people are evil and they need to be treated as such and leave the medical world out of it. God bless you. Signed, Kurt. Well, Kurt, we just got word that the jury in the Lindsay Clancy case has gone home for the day. I'm surprised that they've spent more hours deliberating today without actually reaching a decision about what to do with her. This segment of the program is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Are you ready to be done being a landlord? My Rocket Listing lets you sell your property guaranteed, even with non-paying tenants. Go to NickShivers.com. That's NickShivers.com. To your calls now, let's start with David Cross. And by the way, I should mention, David is a guy who for years, for decades, has been tracking the activities of illegal aliens in the Pacific Northwest and then sharing that information with this program. And he does very good research in which he thoroughly backgrounds where he gets the information, whether it's law enforcement, CBP, ICE, or wherever it is. David, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be back with you, Lars. I came across a really interesting case, and I think you mentioned on your X account about a Mexican national sentenced for trafficking over 70 firearms.
Yep.
The guy, it turns out that he was sentenced to, his name is Vicente Cortez Corwaz, and he was sentenced 18 months in federal prison. But he's a participant in the federal DACA program that was came about through Obama in a memo in 2008. But what interested me, we both have a great interest in firearms. How in the heck does a guy buy 120 firearms since 2014? And my understanding is the Oregon State Police do somewhat of a background check.
Not
how in
much.
The heck does he buy those firearms?
I'll tell you how he does it. And this is what I know about that case in particular. And it's sad. The Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, that's Oregon Live, what used to be the Oregonian newspaper, but they're not really a newspaper anymore. They call this guy in the headline an Oregon resident. Well, I guess technically anybody living in the state of Oregon is an Oregon resident. If the president of Mexico came to Oregon for a week, she would be an Oregon resident for a week. This guy was described as an Oregon resident. He's a Mexican national. And what he did was, when he filled out the Form 4473, I've filled out dozens of Form 4473s over the years to buy guns. So when you buy that gun, you have to fill out the form, and on it you are asked, are you an American citizen? He answered yes, and that was a lie, which means when he actually when he actually bought the gun, every time he signed the form with that lie on it, he was committing a federal felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. They've tagged this guy with the purchase of 70 firearms. He apparently committed that crime at least 70 times, and he's getting a couple of years in prison. Am I right?
Yeah, 18 months, but they're probably giving him some credit for time served. But doesn't the state police have a significant role? And
no.
You think that Oregon,
no.
Be a sanctuary
no.
State, may have a factor here?
Let me tell you why they do not have a significant role. Because in every other state, when you go in, they check with the NICS system, the National Instant Check System, and they say, we've looked on our nationwide database, there is no want or warrant or conviction for Lars Larson, and they clear you to buy a gun. The state police put a little more checking into it, but that's all they do, is they run it through the same system, but at the state level, and determine, are there any wants or warrants or convictions showing in the state system, even though Oregon shares its information with the NICS system, which means you're double-checking effectively. So you're checking all 50 states with the NICS check, and then you check one state, the state of Oregon, with the state check. But it's a double-check of the same information for the most part. So in that case, but what it doesn't check is this guy a legal citizen? Is he legally in the United States? And he's not. This guy is a foreign national. And he was able to buy a gun anyway. And he did it by lying. So, you know, the state police check didn't show anything at all and would not have stopped him from being able to buy a gun. So when people say we need more gun laws, no, we need better enforcement of the laws we already have.
Yeah, Lars, it's really interesting. A lot of your listeners may not know the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program doesn't constitute legal presence. It's just
nope.
Time out from them being deported.
Well, and here's the other thing to consider. Oregon could have said, when they went to Real ID, they could have said, look, if we're going to have a double check on whether or not somebody is legally in the country, let's check. And if their Real ID shows that they are legally in the country, if it actually meant anything, that would be one thing. The problem is Oregon wants to hand out driver's licenses to people who are illegally in the country and hand them a driver's license anyway. And the voters, when they were asked about it, turned that down by a 2-1 margin. And then just a couple of years later, the legislature said, screw you, to the voters. And they said, we're going to do it anyway. So even though the legislature had first given driver's licenses to illegals, that was revoked by the voters. The legislature passed it 2-1. The voters revoked it 2-1. And then just a few years later, the state legislature said, yeah, so what? Spit in the voters' face and said, we're giving the driver's licenses to illegals. You could have had a system that would have established, are you legally registered to drive, number one. But number two, are you legally in the United States? Is this Real ID, and does it indicate that you have proper legal status in the United States? State of Oregon said, we don't want to do that. And sadly, the end result is criminals like this. But I also think it's sad that a guy who's involved in that many firearms into the hands of that many people and committing that many felonies gets 18 months in federal prison. If anybody thinks that makes sense, I'd be glad to hear the naysayer call. By the way, glad to get your calls on a First Amendment Friday. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Lars Larson Show. FM News 101. To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First
Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Friday.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know the fact that college already costs a fortune, and in many cases, it produces a degree that does not necessarily do much for the young man or woman who has that degree. But wait until you hear what some of America's most prestigious universities are actually teaching the students. We're going to get to your phone calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. But first, I want to talk to Rob Tandy. He's a representative of the Young Americas Foundation. Rob, it's good to have you back on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
I like Young America's Foundation. You do a lot of great things for young Americans, as well as maintaining Ronald Reagan's old ranch near Santa Barbara. So I have to thank you for all the things that YAF does. But this comedy and tragedy report, the 32nd year of it, taking a look at what's actually taught at some of America's universities, would you mind sharing some of that with my audience, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Young Americas Foundation has been doing this comedy and tragedy report since 1995. And what we're looking at is what colleges are actually teaching their students. And we go through the course catalogs and the academic programs to see what's really happening inside the classroom on these campuses. And what we're finding is that even though a lot of these schools have gutted or gotten rid of their DEI offices or changed the language they use, the underlying ideology has not changed. You're still seeing courses focused on Marxism, race, and gender ideology, while conservative ideas are often absent from the conversation entirely. So some of these courses in the report, you know, at face value, they look and sound ridiculous. But the serious side to this is that our students are spending tens of thousands of dollars for an education, or what's being called an education. And really what they're exposed to is an indoctrination. Our higher education institutions are not teaching our students how to think. They're teaching our students what to think. And that's a serious problem.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't understand what drives them in that direction. Do you get some sense from 32 years of reporting on this what it is that's making the colleges want to go this direction? Because it's a conscious choice by them or by their board of directors, and they could go a different direction, couldn't they?
Yeah, they absolutely can, and that's why it's important for the Young Americas Foundation to continue to shine a light on what's actually being taught in the classroom. You know, college is supposed to be a place where you're challenged, where you hear different ideas, some you may agree with, some you may disagree with, but instead, too many students are walking into the classroom where there's only one acceptable point of view. And when you're paying tens of thousands of dollars for that education, our students deserve better, so that's why it's YAF's job and other organizations' job to make sure that our students have the opportunity to not only hear from conservative speakers and hear conservative perspectives, but also have the tools that we can equip our younger generation and our students with to go onto their campus and advocate for America's principles, America's founding principles, and conservative principles, so that they can combat this radical left ideology that's so persistent on college campuses.
I'm talking to Rob Tandy, who's the representative for the Young Americas Foundation. So in the interest of educating both parents and some students or potential students as to what's going on at colleges, would you mind giving us a few examples of some of the crazy course offerings?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many inside of the report. A few that, you know, just ring a bell off the top right away is, you know, at Columbia University, that's a institution that's supposed to be such a prestigious academic institution. But they're teaching classes like queer science and tech studies. Or you go to University of Pennsylvania, where, by the way, it costs $5,000, or more than $5,000, for a 3-credit-hour course that's teaching black queer feminism and trans arts of abolition. I mean, this is what we're paying for, and that's being labeled as an education. It's absolutely
look,
insane.
Rob, can you share with the audience, do you have any idea what those things actually are? I mean, or are they just taking as many unwoke words or woke words as they can and stringing them together and applying them to a course? Because it doesn't sound like a real thing, does it?
No, it doesn't, but the shame of it is that it is real. I mean, going to Columbia University's Queer Science and Tech Studies, they're comparing the socioeconomic culture of queer studies and queer theory to technological studies. That doesn't make sense. Why are we paying so much money for a class like that when it's just indoctrination? They're not teaching anything that's going to be useful for our students. What instead what they're trying to do is indoctrinate them in the college level so that when they go out into the real world, that is the ideology that they have. And something can be said for the fact that socialism is such a prevailing thought right now. Well, if you go through the report and you look at these classes that are being taught, it's no surprise. They talk about how capitalism is an inequitable form of the economy. They advertise Marxism. They teach Marxist ideology as the most equitable source of on how to run an economy. So it's no surprise when you look at what's being taught inside of our education system and in our higher education institutions, why this is a prevailing thought in America.
I guess what I wonder, Rob, is these folks not only have to appeal to students and their parents, but they have to appeal to their alumni and their big donors. And, I mean, institutions like Columbia and Harvard and Yale and Stanford, they are multi-billion dollar operations. So are they really going to sponsors or the donors, the donor class, who've made their money at capitalist enterprises and saying, we're going to urinate all over your whole, you know, all of this capitalism stuff where you made your money. But by the way, could you write us a check for this year because we want to put it in our endowment fund? How are they making that sale?
Well, that's the irony in it. And, you know, how they're making that sale, I don't exactly know. But that's why it's Yaff's mission to build the next generation of the conservative movement. And that happens on college campuses. And we do that by putting those principles into action, those conservative principles into action. We run conferences and programs across the country that bring thousands and hundreds of young people together to hear from some of the most influential conservative voices in America. We bring speakers and conservative values to campus to combat this radical ideology. You know, just coming up here in October, we're going to have a few hundred high school students in Philadelphia to exchange those ideas of conservatism so that they can go back to their high school even before they get to college and advocate for free market economics, advocate for American principles.
By the way, Rob, before we run out of time, Rob Jandy from YAF. Rob, can you tell my audience how they can get a copy of this year's Comedy and Tragedy Report?
Yes, you can go to YAF.org, and it's listed on our website. And I encourage your audience definitely to go and take a look at that, because when you really realize what's inside of that report, you start to realize, why am I spending thousands of dollars?
That's right. A parking lot in
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. We got to talk about the governor's race in the state of Oregon. I think this year affords one of the best opportunities Republicans have ever had to displace a Democrat governor after 40 years of Democrat governors and replace that governor Republican for the first time since Victor Attia. But Jeff Eager has made a very important point about this. Jeff, you hear on the show from time to time. He's an attorney, political consultant, and a writer at Oregon Roundup and the former mayor of Bend. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks, Lars. Great to be with you again.
As you sum it up, Tina Kotek has a Green Party problem. Would you mind describing that for my audience?
Yeah, sure thing. So there's a small party in Oregon called the Pacific Green Party that's a very progressive party. It's small, like I said, only about 8,000 registered voters are members of that party. But the Pacific Greens have nominated a guy named Brett Smith to run for governor. And the reason why it's relevant is he's the only third-party candidate in the race. And this is the first time since 2002 that there's only been one additional candidate in addition to the Democrat and the Republican in the race, and that person is to Tina Kotek's left, which presents an opportunity for potential very progressive voters to vote for him rather than Tina Kotek if she thinks she's, if they think she's insufficiently progressive.
Now, you pointed out that the Pacific Green Party is only 8,000 registered voters in the state of Oregon, but you also pointed out that most of Oregon's recent governor's races have been relatively close, a percentage point or two or three?
Yeah, the governor outcomes are actually really consistent in Oregon. They kind of bounce around between like 6-point margin and then like super close within a point or two or three, like the last face-off between Drazen and Kotek. So even if Smith takes, you know, 1-3% of the vote, or maybe potentially more because of some factors at play this cycle, it could be meaningful to the outcome.
And what are those other factors that are at play? Because I've told my audience, I mean, I haven't done an exhaustive list, but Kotek seems to have lost an awful lot of the support that Democrats typically get from labor unions. The folks you would expect to support her have simply said, "Eh, we're not doing an endorsement this time around." And what does that tell us about where her campaign for reelection stands?
Well, nationally, the hard left is trying to stage a takeover of the Democratic Party. We've seen that in New York City. We've seen it in Michigan. And we're seeing it in Oregon. The Oregon Education Association, which is, of course, Oregon's teachers union, longtime Democrat supporting organization, they have yet to endorse Kotek. And that's all tied up with this Portland Democratic Socialists of America hard left kind of takeover of the party, or attempted takeover of the party. So the reason why the Pacific Green candidacy this cycle could be even more meaningful than it otherwise would be is those voters who don't think the Democrats are far enough left have somewhere to put their vote now. They're not going to vote for Drazen, presumably. And if they think that Kotek's too much of a squish, they've got someone to vote for.
Well, then, what is it when they say that you know, say, Tina Kotek, rabid Democrat, as far left as I can imagine, is not far left enough? What is it they want to see from Democrats who would tell them that they've finally gone far enough to the left?
Well, I think one thing they have an issue with is her Prosperity Council, which is, of course, the kind of group of business folks that Kotek put together and gave her some recommendations about how to improve Oregon's economy. They hate that organization because they proposed cutting taxes and reducing regulation. And I think they'd also, this segment of people is very interested in U.S. relations with Israel, and they would like to see the state of Oregon and every kind of political subsidiary thereof to demand divestment from Israel. Kotek's not done a lot with that stuff, and so I could imagine a scenario where the Pacific Greens are very much about divesting from Israel, and that may be an angle that Smith could use to get some of those hard left voters.
Well, tell me this. Do you think that there's any potential for Tina Kotek to, say, throw out some kind of olive branch to the Pacific Greens and say, look, I can come farther left on a few issues enough to co-opt you in? Is there a potential for that? And then in the next, I mean, less than 90 days or not?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And I'm sure that those conversations already have occurred. Whether it's offering them something to get Smith out or just trying to threaten them to get Smith out. I am certain that those conversations are happening or have happened.
Yeah, because I can imagine now the Greens, if they're that far to the left, how they'd react to the idea of Christine Drazen as the governor of Oregon. Jeff, thanks very much. That's Jeff Eager, former Mayor Bend, attorney, political consultant. You can find what he writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. Let's go to Greg. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind on a First Amendment Friday?
To the live Oregon harvesting that's just around the corner, how about if we offer the long-term incarcerated, those that are life without parole or on death row, offer them voluntary early termination, and they can lay on the table for the monsters to want to do the live harvesting?
Wow. What a concept. Although you've noticed that the politically correct out there don't want to use the death penalty anymore, even though it's a great way to deter crime. They don't want to use it anymore. And these days, true life in prison almost does not exist. But I appreciate the call. Let's go to Cyrus. Hey, Cyrus, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, sir. And I enjoy your show. But I just wanted to say I watched the news. Tino Kotick seems to be threatening the people. They want to vote for someone else. That's disgusting. That's not, should not be America. And she would just see everyone as an enemy, I mean, because of the fraud on the illegal people. But I think I said it before. They already, tossed my vote, and I don't know if they gave it to the illegal immigrant or whomever. But I think it's just sure sign of like corrupt dictators in the first world. But
I don't know where you're going with that, Cyrus, but I appreciate the call on First Amendment Friday. Coming up in a moment, men throw twice as hard as women, and one scientist wants you to believe that biology has almost nothing to do with it. His ideology hijacking the science of sex differences.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather station. Missed the Lars Larson Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I never thought, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, are we going to be having debates about whether or not there's a difference between men and women, especially when it comes to athletics and sports, I'd say, no, that's crazy. The differences are clear. They've been recognized for a long, long time. And yet, even now, we've got people arguing with a straight face, mostly from the left. They've been saying, well, you know, men who pretend to be women have to be accepted, so-called trans women have to be accepted as real women. Ignore the biology, simply pay attention to what they say. And yet men throw twice as hard as women. And one scientist wants you to believe that biology has almost nothing to do with it. So I thought I'd talk to Dr. Robert Diener, who's professor of psychology at Grand Valley State University. Dr. Diener, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Lars. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad to have you here because unlike Ketanji Brown Jackson on the Supreme Court, you actually do know something about biology. Is there a way that science can actually settle some of these debates so that we don't have to have them settled because of political ideology?
Well, actually, the data is really clear on a lot of these things. It's a whole other question about why so many scholars ignore the data to, you know, promote their preferred narratives. So we studied overhand throwing, which we've argued definitely has a biological innate component to it. And we took on Ann Fausto Sterling, who's well known, especially for undermining the idea that sex is binary. She wrote an article challenging a claim that my colleague and I, Mike Lombardo, made that the overall evidence for throwing is clear that this is a large sex difference and the sex difference is partly due to biology.
Now, what is she attributed to then? If she says it's not biology, then what is it?
He's what we call a blank slater, right? Steven Pinker coined this term, basically saying there's nothing innate in human psychology at all. There's nothing inborn. Everything is created by the environment. So if you see differences between people, if you see differences between boys and girls, men or women, it's all created by the environment or socialization or parent. The only reason that boys throw better is because they've had more encouragement and opportunities.
Because so it's nurture instead of nature is what they're arguing, right?
Yes. They might say nature and nurture both matter and they are entangled, but in reality, they don't give any time at all for the evidence that biology has a huge impact.
I guess what I don't understand about that argument is this, Dr. Diener, and that is, if you take, for instance, track and field, where if women are going to compete in track and field, and they do, they've got an incentive to be as fast as they can be. And so do the men. And the men broke the 5 mile back in the 1950s. The women have not yet broken the 5 minute mile. And on the track they're on right now, they don't seem especially likely to even get to that benchmark, even though the men have moved considerably beyond it. And that can't be for lack of desire or training or anything else. Doesn't that mean it has to be about biology?
Yes, I agree with you. Obviously, girls and women should have every opportunity to participate in sports, but it would be unfair to have them competing against boys and men, especially those who have undergone male puberty. They have huge advantages. And saying that, well, they haven't been given the opportunities, or they haven't trained hard enough or something like that, that's just deeply disrespectful to those girls and women and their parents and coaches who have tried to give them every opportunity.
Obviously, no, and in fact, a lot of them have trained very, very, very hard. Dr. Diener, I used to, I was a reporter in the city of Eugene, Oregon, and one of the renowned figures there, I think she lives elsewhere now, was Mary Decker Tabb. She's a very good runner. She holds something like 34 records, world records or national records, and even today, some of her records still stand today. So it's not for lack of training or lack of effort or lack of ability or opportunity or anything else, but there's no way in the world she was going to be able to run as fast as men.
Absolutely. Men have inborn advantages. They're linked to the Y chromosome. They're linked to androgen or testosterone production that changes their bodies in ways that advantages their muscles and cardiovascular system, their hearts. So males are naturally blood doping, if you will.
So is there, I mean, because at some point, because the funding for universities, which then means the funding for science, because an awful lot of science is done at universities, is decided by politics. Are we going to forever have this argument going on where there will be people like Anne Fausto Sterling who are going to insist, no, it's all just because of opportunity or training or desire or whatever, but it's not because of innate differences, because the money that comes to universities is going to be decided based on politics, and politics is going to say, politics of the left is going to say that men and women are really no different.
That's a great question. I don't know about the funding. That's a big thing. But I'll just say that if you told me 30 years ago, in fact, the reaction of most of my colleagues when I've sent them my essay was like, I can't believe we're still having this debate. You know, in science, we usually say bad ideas die one scientist at a time. People don't give up their ideas, but eventually they die off. And their students realize these ideas don't work. But this isn't happening with a lot of these crazy progressive ideas, because they're not really looking at these ideas as things to explain the world. They're looking at these ideas as more of like a madrasa or something. You know, like we're supposed to learn these special sacred doctrines. There's no sex differences whatsoever, at least none that advantage men. That couldn't be true. So they're not interested in actually understanding reality or explaining it. They're just interested in promulgating certain dogmas.
I'm talking to Dr. Robert Diener, who's a professor of psychology at Grand Valley State University. You know, the only comparison I can make, because I'm not a scientist either, nor am I an academic. I did about a year and a half of college, but it makes me think back to a time when the church insisted that the universe revolved around the earth and not the earth revolving around the sun and the, you know, how we know the universe is actually put together. And you were told you will either go with this or you will be, you know, you'll be killed. Literally killed. These days, it's more like you'll be canceled. But that's what it feels like today, is that there's a religious doctrine, and the doctrine says that trans men trans women are a real thing, biological men who pretend to be women, and you will back this up, or you'll find your political, your academic career will be over.
Yeah, I mean, the trans issue is an interesting one because it's still crazy, but it's getting better, right? People have realized a lot of these assumptions just don't make any sense, and they actually harm typical girls and women. So I guess that's a bit of optimistic news. I think in the WNBA, they're still having trouble appreciating that. But I think everyday citizens and a lot of sports federations now are realizing people who have gone through puberty as men should not be competing in women's sports. So that's progress.
Well, isn't it great that somebody like Enes, and I don't even follow the NBA or the WNBA that closely, but I love the fact that Enes Kanter Freedom was going to find a way to put them on the spot and say, okay, you want to have men competing against women because they identify as women? Then I'm up for the draft. That's Dr. Robert Diener. He's a professor of psychology at Grand Valley State University, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Young Heroes at your house.
Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. This segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Do what Tina and I did. Set your kids up and your grandkids for success by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com. Our ex-poll question today, should illegal aliens get the privilege of paying only in-state tuition to go to college at taxpayer expense? The U.S. Department of Justice yesterday filed a lawsuit against Arizona, New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington over laws that allow illegal aliens without any legal status to pay in-state college tuition in the states where they live. Consider this. If you take Washington State as an example of that, if you're going to the University of Washington as an undergrad, in-state tuition is about $13,000. Out-of-country tuition, which is what a foreign national would pay, would be about $44,000 or about $31,000 a year more. That is absolutely crazy and at the taxpayer's expense. Let's go to Scott, who's a naysayer. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. Hey, you're always pushing for privatization of government jobs, right?
Yep.
And or a lot of them, anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I feel that's what is wrong with the government, with the campgrounds. Because when we used to have the little army full of forest workers and BLM or whoever in the little green wool suits, that went really well. And then they privatized it, and they turned it into complete 100%, almost 100%.
No, hold on. I missed a step there, Scott. Scott, I missed a step. What did we privatize that you're talking about?
The campgrounds.
No, the state campgrounds are still owned and run by the state of Oregon. The OPRD, the Oregon Parks and Rec Division, is a state agency that's not private.
I think it's ran by a private organization.
No, it is not. No, it is not. The OPRD is a state agency. They're not a private organization.
So when you make your reservations, you're calling a state agency?
Well, they may have farmed out the reservation system alone, but the agency that operates the campgrounds and hires the company to do the reservations is the state. I believe you might be right that they have farmed out they farmed out that piece of making the reservations, but the money that's collected
and the maintenance too.
No, I don't believe so. The state Parks and Rec does the maintenance and everything else on those eight. Now, do they occasionally hire a private contractor? Sure. Most state agencies, even ODOT and WashDOT, will hire private companies to pave a road or build a bridge or do a number of things.
I guess I understand that, yeah.
But it's not privatized at all.
It just seems to me like when they went to full-on, you can't drive into a campground anymore and find a campsite. You know, I'm 67, and I've been camping in Oregon ever since.
No,
I was
you got to have a reservation,
you know?
Don't you?
And we used to be able to. Well, they should leave a bunch of them that are first come, first serve. And then when somebody, and also the gal that lost her money, that's just crap, man. I mean,
I agree.
I guarantee you, think about it. I'll bet you anything that campsite got filled.
No, hold on, Scott. Did you hear the lady when she talked to me yesterday? We had her on,
yeah,
and she said,
"That's what I'm going off of."
Yeah, she and her family were charged $420 because they canceled right. 3 days out from when they were supposed yep. to start their reservation. And she said, by the yep. time she was talking to me, she could see online that that site had already been re-rented to somebody else. So the state of Oregon collected double on that site.
Yeah, I didn't think of the state of Oregon anymore. I thought it was that. Can't think of the name of the company you see all the time over in Central Oregon around Wake You Up and Blina and all that, because those guys
I don't know. I don't know
private,
who that is because
that's a private outfit. That
no, but OPRD, Oregon Parks and Rec Division, is a state agency, but I appreciate the call. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, thanks for the call from Klamath Falls, and thanks for listening on KFLS. What's on your mind today on a First Amendment Friday?
Well, first off, we have a local resident by the name of John Bush. He's 84 years old. He's a veteran. He is in a wheelchair. He got in an altercation with someone stealing some of his property the end of May, and they have an arraignment for him this coming Monday. So I'm just kind of trying to get the word out, and hopefully we can get
the word about what? What? Why is he being? What charge is he being arraigned on?
Well, I'm not sure of the charge, but he shot the person stealing property, and he died. The person.
Oh,
died.
Well, he's probably going to be arraigned on what, manslaughter? So, what?
I'm not sure. I'm looking at I couldn't find much on the.
Do you know this man?
Go ahead.
Do you know this man?
Oh, I know of him.
Okay.
A friend,
so
a good friend of his, it's a good friend of mine called and I said, you know, Lars Larson would be a good one. I was hoping he would do this, but I didn't mind listening to your program today on my phone instead of the radio.
Well, but tell me this, what, so this man has been arrested. He's actually been charged as KDRV, which is a good TV news operation down there, which is Channel 12. He's been arrested for homicide. And he's 84 years old, but he's being arrested on manslaughter charges, according to the Klamath Herald and News, which is a newspaper I used to deliver when I was a kid. But if he shot the guy multiple times and didn't have a good legal reason, he's going to have a problem, isn't he?
Yeah. He's got a problem. You know, my problem with the whole thing is the person he shot, habitual thief, lifelong criminal. You know, if our justice system was working, John wouldn't have had the opportunity to have this guy trespass on his property.
Hold on. But you said John, okay, the shooter is John Bush, the 84-year-old man, right? Okay.
Correct.
And he said the man was trying to break into Bush's vehicle. The man confronted him, resulted in a brief altercation that led to the shooting. I would imagine he's going to claim that it was self-defense, but maybe apparently apparently there's surveillance footage of the area. So I wonder if he's going to have the facts on his side when it comes to saying this was self-defense. He may have a tough time. If the police have decided to arrest him, it's probably because they've looked at the case and it doesn't look like self-defense. But Jason, thanks so much. Mike, thanks so much for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.